Welcome to the University of Wisconsin Foundation, Bascom Hill Society Showcase Series podcast, featuring some of the University of Wisconsin's best and brightest faculty and staff. This installment features Kurt Kosmarek, Yuri Danilov, and Mitchell Tyler from the Tactile Communication and Neurorehabilitation Laboratory at UW-Madison.
Thank you, Sandy. It's a real pleasure to be here with you today. And it really doesn't matter whether or not I'm provost, as it turns out. My interest in this particular project in this field actually predates everything except for being chair of medical physics. Because when Paul Baccarita came to campus, he spent a lot of time in the vicinity of our Department of Medical Physics for kind of obvious reasons. And his level of creativity was simply spectacular. And he would describe some of his ideas. And I actually was extraordinarily skeptical. It never occurred to me that the degree of brain plasticity and malleability that would be available to us going forward in the future would really be at the level that he prescribed and suggested. Moreover, how one would execute any kind of technical device to actually take advantage of that. I immediately imagined a room full of computer racks that was probably weighed something like 4 metric tons and could be moved only by Reynolds Transfer Company. And the concept of interfacing that to get physical information into the human in an empowered way, I thought was completely unlikely, all right? He was very persistent. He would continue to tell me about that to the point I had to lock my door so he couldn't bother me. And I became a believer over time. He systematically demonstrated some of these ideas and painted a future that I began to believe in. And the result of that has been quite striking. This activity in the department has grown dramatically. WECARB was founded and is being increasingly successful. I think you're beginning to see the kind of national attention this kind of area of research and science can develop. And this all results from the persistence and creativity of an individual scientist who really saw the future well ahead of when the future would be with us. He envisioned the condensation of technology, the macro ability of us to translate physiological information into applications in a real-time environment. He really conceived of all of that from the get-go, and that was, 30 years ago? Something like that, 30 or 40 years ago. So I've become a distinct believer, and we have the pleasure today of having some of the leaders in that organization with us. Kurt Kosmarek, you've been with it since 1992, so it was about the time I was moving over to the dean's office, as a matter of fact, the end of the medical physics part and movement into the dean's office. And Yuri Danilov, who is sitting over here on my left, and these two young individuals, maybe not so young anymore, have been carrying the torch. We regret deeply the passing of Paul from our environment. But he left a legacy that was really quite striking. So you're going to hear a few remarks today from Mitch Tyler, who is a member of that team and has been a major engineering force with respect to this. This is really now a combination of engineering, science, physics, and neuroscience. The level of neuroscience is extremely exciting. So I think you're going to hear some things that you hadn't anticipated or appreciated, and I hope you find it as attractive and endorsing as I do. Mitch.
Well, thank you for that gracious introduction. I want to take just a moment to thank Provost DeLuca for that kind introduction. I also want to thank Sandy Wilcox for sponsoring this, and I have a specific thank you for Marilyn Rhodes, who was the catalyst for conceiving and initiating this whole process. I have special thanks for you, and on behalf of Yuri and Kurt and myself, we're grateful to be here. We thank you for being here on a gorgeous day, and we'll try to tease your imaginations a little bit the way that Paul did. The formal title is Amazing Brain, that Plastic Brain, that how to launch a company. My subtext is a story of 5 epiphanies, because it's really the highlights. I mean, as Provost DeLuca intimated, Paul would latch on to an idea, and he would let it just ruminate in his brain. And he became so engaged in it that pretty soon it was just a sheer force of nature. He would get you so convinced of it, and he would just keep driving at these things that pretty soon, even as you indicated, the most skeptical and cautious of individuals, you can't help but believe that Paul was onto something. And we, by virtue of our presence on campus and Paul's incredible ability to not only conceive of these incredible ideas, but his ability to create collaborations between various disciplines that normally wouldn't have talked to each other, that we have engineers, neuroscientists, clinicians all working together on this common problem. To just borrow a quick quote from Sir Isaac Newton, we are in fact standing on the shoulders of a giant. Paul was really a visionary, well ahead of his time, and a lot of times he was frustrated with the pace of technology and science because he could see where he wanted to go. But it took all of us a while to get there. Now, fortunately, we are there, and I wanted the rest of the presentation is to specifically address how we got to where we are right now. I'm going to share some clinical data that we've just accumulated in the last year. But before we get to that point, I'd like to go forward just to give you a quick background. 1960. Conventional wisdom, based on a lot of clinical research that had been up to that point, said the brain was hardwired. It doesn't change. At only 3 points in your life, would it have the opportunity to change in some constructive way? That would be when you're a newborn, somewhere around puberty, and again at about the time that you hit your late teen years. After that, you were stuck with what you have. And if there's any trauma to it, that's it. You basically have to just learn to live with it. There's no prognosis for any improvements, and you just have to learn to live with your situation. Paul's experience flew in the face of that. He was a rising star in the visual neuroscience field. He was being mentored by a Nobel laureate who had great hopes for his career. And then Paul's father had a massive stroke at the age of 69. He was recently widowed. He had a massive stroke that debilitated him to the point where he couldn't feel one half of his body, couldn't talk, couldn't feed himself, couldn't take care of normal daily activities. And after a month in a rehab facility, a residential rehab facility, Paul's brother, George, and Paul decided, Papa's not getting any better. They're not doing anything for him, and they felt it was an indignity that this revered man, who was a professor of languages at City University of New York, would be basically a vegetable. They couldn't accept that, so they collaborated to create an unorthodox retraining program to force their father's brain to start working again. After about 18 months, he was able to return to work. Remarried, lived happily for the next 7 years until he passed away from a heart attack. Now, at the time of the autopsy on his father, they revealed that 97% of the brainstem had been damaged by the original stroke 7 years earlier. Yet, he was able to function normally. He went back to work, moved to California, joined the West Coast scene, and was a fully functional member of life, of society. And this flew in the face of everything Paul had been taught. How can this be? How can the brain change this much in such a short period of time, given the massive damage? So Paul's career took a radical left turn, or right turn, depending on your political affiliation. And he decided, well, okay, visual neuroscience is really interesting. And to the ire of his mentor, Ragnar Ganit, who was the 1956 Nobel laureate, Paul decided to go back and do a residency in rehabilitation medicine, a step down in terms of prestige. He was going back there and fixing broken people. That was just not, he was going to be the next great thing. Well, Paul reasoned that there's something going on here. There's a secret that the brain has revealed a glimpse, but how do we make that happen? So Paul started developing this theory of brain plasticity, and he felt that there are three elements to it. that the brain and the body need to have some performance requirements, okay, some functional tasks that need to perform. There need to be information exchanged from the brain to the body and the body back to the brain to perform that task. And there need to be a pathway. Now, in the case of Paul's father, that pathway had been damaged. How then can we get this information back into the brain so that it could regain its function? That was Paul's mission. That was his obsession, if you will. And he took off on an avenue of scientific pursuit to develop sensory substitution as a vehicle for demonstrating brain plasticity, a way of forcing the brain to adapt to a new set of conditions. So how would we do that? Now, let me just back up here for a sec. Sensory substitution, this is not a new concept. This is as old as civilization, right? The long cane is a perfect example. You move it around. You don't think, oh, I'm touching an object. Oh, I'm feeling the carpet. I'm feeling the wall. I'm feeling the fire hydrant. Very quickly, with training, the information that the end of the stick picks up becomes a map of the environment. And Paul realized that we could use the skin as another sensory modality because the skin is the largest organ in the body, is the largest sensory organ in the body, and it's underutilized. So Paul reasoned that if we could use the sense of touch, and because he's a visual neuroscience, of course, what would he want to take first shot at? Blindness. It seemed like a logical place to go. And it's very obvious. Vision, loss of the eyesight. Why can't we just take, for example, a video camera and take that same information and present it to the skin? Paul's great belief is that somehow the brain is going to figure out how to utilize that information. So with that, we have a slide, and I'm going to let Paul tell the story in his own words.
We don't see with the eyes, for example. We don't hear with the ears. All of that goes on in the brain. Remember, if I'm looking at you, the image of you doesn't get beyond my retina, just the back of my eye. From there to the brain, to the rest of the brain, it's pulses along nerves. Well, those pulses aren't any different than the pulses from the big toe. It's the way the information they carry is in the frequency and the pattern of pulses. And so if you can train the brain to extract that kind of information, then you don't need the eye to see. You can have an artificial eye.
His first device substituted the sense of sight for the sense of touch on the subject's back. Made from an old dentist's chair, a camera became the eyes, and the light pulses were then routed to blunted needles that delivered the pattern of the object onto the back.
It's a telephone, and the receiver is to the right.
So that was Paul's first technical success and a means of demonstrating that, in fact, you could communicate information from one sensory modality, from the sense of touch, to represent vision. So let's leap forward, because I, to do justice to Paul's story, and I don't get royalties from the book, okay, so that's my disclaimer. If you want to read more about Paul's story and about the amazing frontier of neuroscience, I recommend this book, The Brain That Changed Itself, by Dr. Norm Doidge. It has a number of stories in there. We, by some great fortune, are the first chapter in there, but it's a fascinating read. It's like a science adventure novel at the boundaries of science. So Paul reasoned, okay, we spent the next 20 years trying to figure out how to get information into the brain via the skin. And one day, Paul cornered, kind of pigeonholed Kurt and said, I got this idea. Now, as engineers, we don't like to have current passed into the body, right? You know, the body is designed to not have electricity pass through it. Well, Paul said, but the tongue is a great place to provide the stimulation. Now, on the video you just saw, that was a large dentist chair with vibrotactors in there, right? Not terribly portable, right? If you want a truly useful device, something that you could wear, if you're a person with a visual disability or blindness, you want to navigate in your environment, you would want something that's wearable and that's discreet. You could have a little pair of glasses, go out into your environment, and be able to tell where you are in space. Paul thought the tongue is a perfect interface. Every child who has ever stuck a 9-volt battery on their nose, you know, spit is a really good conductor. It's a safe environment. We could stick it right on the tongue, okay, an array of electrodes, and we can control the stimulus. Now, this is where Kurt comes in, because he spent the better part of his career figuring out how to control current being passed in the body. In our lab, we don't allow profanity, and the S word is in shock. Shock. That's a profanity in our lab. We do not shock people. That's uncontrolled current. We provide stimulation, and we can control that stimulation. And in this case, one of our patients, actually the first patient that we tested on, described that it feels like champagne bubbles. So, forward. Worf loved the idea of this tongue-machine interface, okay, as an information interface to the brain, and decided they were going to patent it. And said, well, let's go ahead and start a company, because there's nobody else in the universe that's doing this weird thing with the tongue to talk to the brain. We said, okay, we'll start a company. Well, the logical first descendant of that technology with the tongue-based tactile display is vision system. So what you see here is an array of 144 electrodes, and a very simple, this is our very first generation system, okay? This is a $20 conference camera that you could buy to clip onto your computer. Very low resolution. Why? We don't need anything more sophisticated. Paul was brilliant at getting us to think about how can we make it as simple, off the shelf, as useful as possible, because if the more exotic it gets, the more expensive it gets, the more likely it's going to break. So Paul's notion was just give the brain the information, it'll figure it out. As he said, we don't see with the eyes, we see with the brain. So just get the information there, the brain will figure it out. Here's our very first tongue display system, shoebox size contraption. Not entirely mobile, but it's a step in the right direction. It's certainly not the dentist chair. What we have here is a young man reaching for a Coke can. So this is the first demonstration that we're closing the information control loop. He's able to perceive the information from the camera on his tongue, guide his hand, grab the can. The whole control process, the sensory motor control process, is complete. In fact, it's so fast and so dynamic that you can see his hand is blurring in this image here. He's reaching for a ball that has been rolled across the table by the experimenter, and he's able to track the trajectory and the velocity of the ball and grab it. This is pretty exciting stuff. And Paul was giddy, as you can imagine. The current version of this device is now the BrainPort Vision System. This article, this gentleman right here, was actually shown in the Washington Post last Thursday. They're showcasing this technology. It's been on CBS News. National Eye Institute awarded it as the new frontier of technology for blindness in the United States at their 40th anniversary celebration. So, about that time, I had a massive inner ear infection. I lost my sense of balance. I could not tell where up was. Now, the sense of balance is regulated by this tiny little structure called the vestibula. This is the cochlea that you hear with. Those are the labyrinth that allow you to tell where your head is rotating up, down, and sideways. And right on the very tip there, that little black spot, is called the utricle. That's your gravity sensor. If that's damaged, for any reason, you can experience any one of these various symptoms. I had them all. And as a consequence, for 5 days, I could crawl from room to room, and I would fixate my vision, and I would try not to vomit or fall down or do anything that would perturb me. And I thought, this is really, really awful. It was a horrible experience. Thankfully, it resolved. However, not everybody is so lucky. 1 in 3 will develop it in their lifetimes. If you're over 65, there's a 50% chance you're going to experience some form of this. It can happen for any reason, including just aging. It can be a drug reaction. This next person that I'm going to show you was a woman who had an ototoxic response. In other words, she had a reaction to gentamicin, which is a very powerful antimicrobial. It destroyed her inner ear. So this is Cheryl right here. The reasoning is, okay, we're just going to replace the balance sensor that's in my ear with an accelerometer mounted on a hard hat, talking to that same shoebox in the computer, and feedback that information. Keep in mind that about 15 million people at any point in time have a chronic substantive balance disorder. So we're all susceptible. Now, in order to do that, basically what we did here was we just mapped the information. So if you tipped your head one way, the stimulus would be on one side of your tongue. Very simple. Just imagine if you're hanging a weight on a string, and if you tip one side, the string's going to veer one way or the other. Very simple, just mapped to the tongue. In order to do that, we had to figure out how to send the stimulus to make sure that this tongue could feel it. The tongue is not a homogeneous structure. In the back, sensation isn't quite as strong. In the front, it is strong. So we had to figure out how to make that work efficiently. This is our very first patient, Cheryl Schultz, who the narrator will give you the background on her.
Life isn't easy for Cheryl Schultz.
Dang it.
Cheryl's so-called normal world is a constant struggle, one marked by how difficult even everyday tasks like walking can be. Now watch what happens after only 20 minutes with the TDU.
Easy, easy. You can do it if you can. Touch the table.
Cheryl's world is normal again. No more wobbles, no more feeling of floating in space. The woman who just 20 minutes ago needed help standing is now jumping rope.
That was not within protocol.
And if that doesn't make you feel like dancing, nothing will. Tyler and Daniloff have already come further than they expected by creating a system that gives Schultz and countless others even a temporary glimpse of their old life. But the final steps may be the toughest. Shrinking a desktop TDU to the size of a dental retainer is feasible but financially challenging, and then there will be even more government testing. A final act in one woman's struggle to make her world a little less wobbly.
Come here. Oh, God, it's so wonderful.
So if you'll freeze on the next one. So that was in 2002, okay? And as Jerry Huffman from Wisconsin Public Television just intimated on that, we had imagined that this was going to be a device that was going to have to be worn in your mouth 24/7, right? This is Cheryl, 2008. She went off of disability, went back to college, finished her undergraduate degree in rehab psychology, now is working as an advocate for other people with disabilities, and as you can see, she's functionally normal. She's also not using the BrainPort device at any time now. She doesn't need it. She effectively has regained normal function. So, how'd that happen? Well, this was a watershed. This was our fourth epiphany, if you will. The retained improvement in function was not something we expected. This was a windfall for us, if you will. What it allowed is, as they talked about in the narration, we had imagined a device that was going to be something you picked up off your nightstand, popped in your mouth, and wore it all day. And that was going to be your gravity sensor, right? Now, we can go with simple hardware, something you wear around your neck. You only have to wear it twice a day for 20 minutes to regain, recalibrate and tune up your brain to regain function again. And we see this progressive, over time, accumulation and improved function. So Cheryl went from being a, quote, wobbler, unquote, to being fully functional over the course of 6 years. Current status on the BrainPort Balance device, it's now been used in over 1,000 patients in the U.S., around the world. It's available in Europe, Canada, South America, and now in the Soviet Union. And it's in Russia. Oh. I'm going to catch hell for that later. Now, in the course of doing this research, as I mentioned earlier, Cheryl was an ototoxic. You know, she had a very specific reaction to gentamicin. It was a very specific damage to her balance system. We realized, well, if it's working this well, how can we expand this? Where else would it work? So we went with patients like Cheryl because the whole idea was to start with something that was well-defined and well-controlled, expand that. So we went with bilateral vestibular issues that were not unique to this specific type of damage. Then we expanded that to bilateral and unilateral vestibular dysfunction, so all still peripheral dysfunction. We kept expanding our scope of inquiry to movement disorders, and at this point in time, we are actually embracing cognitive and emotional effects as well. So the next slide actually shows we realized we're onto something here. Something really phenomenal is taking place, and we're just sort of dancing around the edges here. We're kind of tickling, you know, the edge of our understanding. We started out here, ototoxic. So these are all problems with the sensor itself. It's a peripheral nervous system problem. These are central, so it's something more deeper in the brain, or something that doesn't even relate to the vestibular system at all. Irrespective of the nature of the damage or the problem, including traumatic brain injury, Parkinson's disease, MS, idiopathic neuropathy, we kept seeing the same sorts of things pop up. Common observations, all these improvements, balance, steadiness, posture, gait, speech, sleep. We were training for balance, trying to improve people's ability to stay upright and not fall down and get through their day, and yet they're improving in ways we never imagined. Simultaneously, we're seeing a reduction in depression, fatigue, tinnitus, ringing in the ears. So they started realizing there's something deeper going on here. So, quick anatomy lesson, 20 seconds or less. We're stimulating two branches of the cranial nerves. That information is the trigeminal nerve and the facial nerve. They go into the brainstem. Next slide. As Yuri likes to call it, the brainstem is sort of like NASA control center. It's the most compact region of the central nervous system. It's where all of the cranial nerves converge. All the pathways going to the brain from the body, all the sensory information going up to the brain, and all the motor control signals from the brain to the body all pass through the brainstem. You have this massive convergence of information going both ways. It's like, to paraphrase Vice President Gore's analogy, it's the information superhighway of the body or of the brain. And he didn't coin that, right? So this was the fifth epiphany. And this is something that Yuri was driving at for a while, trying to understand what was going on here, is that we were modulating the brain. When you look up modulation, it means to modify or to exert influence. We realized that and the question was, how can this tiny little signal that we were presenting to the tongue affect so many symptoms under so many circumstances? What's the common thread here? Well, neuromodulation. We're modulating brain function. So we thought, okay, well, if this tiny little signal from this balance device is having this effect, let's amp it up. Let's make the whole thing, put it on steroids and make it work even better. So we use a new stimulation routine on a different type of display. And we're actually now injecting about 1.3 million spikes, little tiny electrical stimulation to the brain to create action potentials, excite the brain, get all the healthy tissue firing together, synchronizing it, making it work, and enforcing this cooperation within the brain. As Mike Merznick, who is another one of the leading neuroscientists, and he's represented in the book here, if it fires, it wires. Getting the brain to talk to itself in a coordinated fashion. Now, that's only half of the equation. The other half is that's the brain trying to tell the body what to do. But if the body can't follow, there's no point in going through these exercises. So what we need to also do is have these targeted exercises, either physical or cognitive exercises, to make sure that the brain is talking to the body, body's talking to the brain. The goal was to actually force neuroplasticity, to induce it, to basically drive the system to start working again after a trauma. Irrespective of the trauma, it doesn't matter what the cause is. We can deal with balance, movement disorder, gait problems, and now we're starting to see evidence of cognitive and perhaps even mood disorders as well. So, increased magnitude of the rate spectrum and positive effects, reducing the symptoms, and we think it's universally applicable. So, now just to give you context, okay, neuromodulation is not new. You've probably heard of deep brain stimulation, application for Parkinson's disease. It's highly invasive, but it does work quite well. Cochlear implants have been around for 25, almost 30 years. Vagal nerve stimulation, you've probably heard about that, as well as an implantable device to deal with epilepsy. We're taking the middle road, okay? That's the high road. These are high-tech approaches, but we took the middle road, a non-invasive approach using existing pathways. As long as the tongue and the nerves that innervate the tongue are active, we can pass a signal in there, get it to the brainstem, and start to affect these changes. We train for balance and movement, but we see broad-spectrum effects. So at this point, we've seen the evidence. We developed a theory. Now we wanted to test the hypothesis, because this was all great and wonderful, but you try to say, we think we can change your brain. We can fix your brain. I would be a little skeptical if somebody says, I'm going to stick this thing on your tongue and I'm going to fix your brain. And you would be right to be skeptical. We're even skeptical within our lab. We still don't believe all the results that we get. So we wanted to actually prove it to ourselves, first of all, second to the scientific community, and third to the clinical community, because they're the ones that are actually going to have to deploy this if it, in fact, works. So our very first exercise was to just see, can we see changes in the brain in response to the stimulation? Well, that took a number of things. We wanted to actually use this, a modified training regimen, modified stimulation. Will we see improved function that relates to changes in the brain? That's the second part. I mean, if you can stimulate the brain, maybe it lights up or does something different, but does it mean anything? Does it improve function in the real world? And we also had to develop new techniques for imaging the brainstem, because the technology at the time was there, but the specific techniques were not developed, so we had to actually do that. So, next slide. This was a very exciting day for us. This was our first collection of results from last summer. What we have here, this is the brainstem. This is the anatomical diagram of the brainstem here. The red indicates the greatest increase in blood flow. Increase in blood flow in fMRI, it's called a BOLD, or blood oxygen level detection, indicates increase in blood flow. Blood flow is correlated with increased activity. What we see here is these regions are all increasing activity, and they correspond to this huge network of control circuitry in the brainstem. So we are, in fact, according to this data, improving brain function. The next video is going to show something about, now before you actually run it, this individual was a high-salaried sales executive until 6 years ago, when she had a car accident, traumatic brain injury, severe damage to her brain. Cervical vertebrae were damaged, crushed nerves. She experienced balance problems, movement problems. She's unable to use a cane because she doesn't have enough limb control to be able to lean on the cane without worrying about falling down and hurting herself. Visual field has been deviated by about 30 degrees. She went to 11 different neurologists or neurotologists over the course of 5 years. They all said, well, we can fuse your spine, and here's a pair of prismatic glasses to correct for this visual field deviation that she had. Her eyes would be pointing straight, but the image looked as though it was coming from about 30 degrees off axis. She had to wear a pair of prismatic glasses to walk around in the environment and hang on to somebody's arm or to a wall, because she couldn't trust using a cane. So this is one of the tests we do. It's called the dynamic gait test. This is just a simple walking task, something we all take for granted. She is unable to make even the simplest movements through her environment. This is her after 48 minutes. She's not only walking straight, she can look down, look up, and navigate around these cones. And this is 5 days later. Her symptoms abated. She still had some headaches. She still had visual hypersensitivity. So things moving in her visual field would upset her. The color red, for some reason, was very disturbing to her. But for 4 days, she felt better than she had. She felt, as she said, practically normal. You good old boys have fixed me. Okay? Then the symptoms started to subside. She couldn't use the device. She went back to her home in Alabama, and now she's back to where she was. But we can impact these individuals. Okay, we can make dramatic changes in brain function in a very short period of time. So, That leads us to the next study. We thought, okay, this is fantastic. We are able to make significant changes in the brain. Let's try this on another population that is underserved. There is no cure for MS. There's no treatment even for the symptoms except for one pharmacological agent, and I'll reveal that at the end. We want to test this on a target population and see if we can deal with it, because people with MS have a lot of the same problems with balance, gait, movement control, and tremor. So it's a test case to see how extensible this technology is. So go ahead. Again, the gait test that you just saw the lady performing before, this is day zero. This is 2 weeks later. This is the score from 0 to 25. Everybody makes an improvement over time. What I want you to give your attention to over here is the group average started at about 10. Significant dysfunction. Group average at the end of 2 weeks is at 20. Anything below 19, or above 19, is considered a clinically significant improvement and avoidance of falls. On average, the population improved 9 points on a 24-point scale. That's unheard of. 1 point is considered clinically significant. This is a 2-week intervention with patients with MS. The average duration that they'd had the MS was 8.6 years. Since diagnosis, the symptoms had probably been well before that. This is busy, but this is the most exciting for me. I'm getting chills just looking at it right now, not because I like red and green. On the red is the response. This is a survey that was conducted. It's a validated survey for MS symptoms. It has 29 questions on this questionnaire. The patients filled it out before their training and at the end of the 2-week intervention. The score goes from how much this particular indicator, whether it's a physical task or limits on socializing, sleep, it scores it from not at all affected by MS to extremely affected by MS. As you can see, every single indicator here, in the red, the black dot is the mean for that population, for that group. After 2-week intervention, on average, every one of these indicators improved. Okay? This is not only statistically significant, which is good, but clinically significant, because if you take that bar, use your thumb and hold it up between any two sets of boxes there, say that box and that box, what we see is an improvement that is phenomenal. This is unheard of. 29 different indicators: balance, just uncoordination, depending on others, slowness, bowel and bladder control. This is a really big issue. Sleep, concentration, all of these improved. Any one of these would be reportable in the Journal of Neurology. We have 29 of them to report. So as you can imagine, we're kind of excited about this. I want to show you another video now. Ah, pharma. Famperidine is the drug, the one drug that is approved. It improves function a little bit, but it has some pretty nasty side effects. It only works in about 35% of the population. And it costs a mere $10,000 a year. This individual came into our laboratory. He has MS. He was an electrician by trade. He's performing the gait task as well, but he can't walk. He needs to use the walker. If you'll notice, his right hand and the walker keeps veering off to the left because his right hand is tremoring to the point where he can't control it. 12 days later, he's not using the walker. His gait still has some anomalies, but he's able to perform the task. This is an enormous improvement in the quality of life for him. Before, he would not have been able to step over this box. He's also using his right arm and is able to maintain balance and gait. He's able to use both feet going up and down the stairs. Before that, he would hike himself up, 1 foot, hike up, 1 foot, hike up. He's also using his right hand to balance himself, to grasp things. His right hand and right arm were basically useless to him when he came into our lab. It's still an effort. He's not cured, but he has made tremendous improvement in 2 weeks. This in itself is most important. This is his right hand. He's right-handed. He's able to wad up the piece of paper and throw it. So that's where we've been. These results I just showed you for the MS patients, we just finished that study 6 weeks ago. So now, where are we going from here? And that's an appropriate question. Well, as this diagram is a little busy, but I want to point you to, so this is the how far we're going, and this is where we're going, okay? We have demonstrated that vestibular imposture dysfunction, we went from feasibility, technical development, the device is now in a company, it's being manufactured, it's being tested, it's going through FDA clinical trials right now. We have just finished the MS study right here. We are poised to start an at-home study, okay? A lot of the leading journals right now are advocating for not just the clinical intervention in the clinic, but for at-home training. This represents a huge breakthrough for us because now people don't have to come in to get therapy once a week, once every 2 weeks. They can take the device home and actually continue their therapeutic interventions on out as long as they need to and maintain quality of life. So we have, at this point here, we're just ready to start a Parkinson's study as well. Traumatic brain injury, stroke, cerebellar ataxia, we are poised to start these studies as well. We're at the verge. We've proven to ourselves and we've proven to some of our skeptical colleagues that this is possible. So we want to go forward. Who's affected by this and why is this important? Well, here's the numbers. We've already dealt with multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, stroke, traumatic brain injury. These are the economic impact on the United States, just in direct dollars that can be accounted for. So if you look at these six diseases, or just these six diseases right here, 20 million people roughly, and $260 billion a year. That's direct costs. It does not take into consideration indirect cost of a loved one or a care provision that's not being paid for by Medicare or Medicaid. It does not consider the loss of income or the impact on the economy. This is direct medical care costs. Imagine what we can do if we can take 0.1% of that away and impact the quality of life and make some sort of, you know, a reasonable, you know, a profitable industry out of this. So we have five primary tracks that we are proposing in our lab in order to move this technology forward. First and foremost is to formalize the therapeutic intervention. We need to move forward and understand how the therapy needs to be applied, optimize it for the particular disability, modify the stimulus, because what works for Parkinson's disease may not work for MS. We are ready to go with a 3-month intervention right now. In fact, the Human Subject Committee on campus is reviewing our protocol. We've gone from a 2-week intervention to now we want to extend that to have a 2-week intervention plus an at-home training program with, and I'll show you a slide of this, a device that looks like this. It went from the dentist chair 40 years ago to a shoebox 10 years ago to a device this size. Now, this is a prototype. This is version 1.0. This was actually funded by a grateful patient who helped us develop the technology to this point. We're ready to go. Multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, stroke. Now, if you'll indulge me for a moment, I have a particular passion for traumatic brain injury. Military traumatic brain injury is a huge issue for us right now, irrespective of your opinions on the war. It's still coming home to roost with us. Out of the 1.8 million personnel that have served in the active duty in the Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom operations since 2003, about 180,000 personnel have come back with a diagnosis of traumatic brain injury. Most of them have resolved, but not all of them. About 51,000 of them are chronic, and they're having enormous impact on the quality of life. Balance, vertigo, disorientation, cognitive effects, okay? Their ability to work, to maintain relationships, to be productive in society has been severely diminished. Personality and mood disorders, these individuals have a lot of drug problems. They try to self-medicate because of the severity of their symptoms. We can help them now. That sounds bold, and it is bold, but we know we can have a significant impact on their quality of life right now based on our studies. We want to expand this to autism, Alzheimer's disease. It's a neurodegenerative disorder. We believe we can treat that as well by slowing down the onset of symptoms. Aging effects as well. So it's an aggressive agenda, but we are confident that we can go forward with that based on the results we've had so far. Now, in order to do this, we're going to need help. We're three guys in a lab over in the med school. And we want, this sounds grandiose, but we want to change the world. Going to need a whole lot of help, okay? So we want to establish, and we've been talking with the administration, making the first initiatives to establish a center of excellence on the campus, within the university, within the existing departments, but intentionally forging collaborations between departments that traditionally have not been all that involved with each other. Now, there's a lot of steps we have to go through to get there. But the benefit of this is that we can take it out of our lab, get into the clinic, into clinicians' hands, into the home, start having a standard training regimen, increase the access to the technology, and to start propagating this in waves from the three of us to a clinic on campus, to other clinics on other campuses, into the clinic in your neighborhood. Again, ambitious, but it's the only way this is going to get out there and start changing the world. Obviously, this funny-looking little cocktail stirrer, if you will, needs to evolve to the next generation. We need to develop this the next step, probably two generations. We need to license the technology and get it developed so that it's ready to go into commercial production. It's going to need regulatory approval. This is not going to happen overnight. But this is the pathway towards getting this device commercialized. When it does become commercialized, we will be positioned to go into the $2 billion a year neuromodulation market. Okay, it's huge and it's growing. Again, three guys in a lab, neuroscientists and engineers. We want to expand our understanding of what's going on at an underlying level, what's actually happening at the brain, at the cellular level, at the synaptic level. How are these global changes being affected? How can we optimize that process? How can we maximize the benefit with the least amount of intrusion on your life? We don't know. That's a fourth arm that we need to pursue in order to develop our understanding of the comprehensive effects of this stimulation. We have not seen a single adverse event in all of our 11 years now of research with this device. So somehow we're making the brain better. So far, there's no downside. We have a number of theories about that, but I won't go into detail on that right now. The fifth track, if Paul were here, he would be grinning. And you probably know that smile when he got that look in his eye like he's pursuing something. We have been told by people who are very knowledgeable in this area that we are actually stimulating regions of the brain, in specific the fourth ventricle of the brain, that is responsible for, it's the birthing ground or the breeding ground for undifferentiated stem cells that will eventually become neural tissue. It's possible. It's still a long ways out there, but it's possible we could start to work with people who are doing stem cell research, have our device help not just fix broken brains in terms of retraining the existing tissue, but actually grow new healthy tissue. It seems kind of fantastic, I agree, but people that are much smarter than we are about these things seem to think that there's a lot of promise there. So maybe that's Epiphany 6. Just to, again, context, we are working with colleagues in biomedical engineering, neurology, departments all over campus. We have a number of colleagues. So I misspoke in a way in that it's not just the three of us. We actually have intensive collaborations with a number of departments and colleagues on campus in order to push this forward because we can't do it alone. There's so much to be learned. We're also collaborating with the leading neuroscientists. Again, a little plug for the book here. Mike Merznick at UCSF has developed this a new way of, the chapter is called Building a Better Brain. And Pasquale Leon is a new rising star in neuroscience at Harvard. Yuri was just out there 2 weeks ago in his lab. We're working out a collaborative relationship. He was here for the inaugural lecture for the Paul Bacharita Memorial lecture series. And Maurice Biteau at Montreal, he's a leading researcher in fMRI. We also are getting a lot of inquiries, literally every day, from either patients or colleagues around the world. So other people are sensing that we've tapped into something pretty vital here too. So stay tuned. We've got some exciting news to share with you in the future. We would be remiss to not thank at least a partial list of the people who have gotten us to where we are right now. It's much more extensive than this. This is just the people that we have had immediate impact, have immediately impacted our work, as well as the graduate students that have worked with us. This could be pages of people that got us to where we are right now. And the funding that got us to this point are numerous. We would not have gotten here without the gracious funding of the federal and private foundations. So, capping things. Right on time. We have developed a therapeutic toolbox. It's still primitive. We've demonstrated it in one clinical population. We've got, small numbers in three other populations. We see the extensibility. So far, we're the only ones that are doing this. So we think we are really well positioned to move this forward. And the thing, as you saw with Cheryl or with the other patients, is that we get big dividends. Every time we get a hug, it's worth $1 million. It's the best thing in the world to have somebody, crying and hugging you, and they can't hold the video camera because their spouse is walking down the hallway. I can't tell you how many times people have walked in with the walker and left with the walker under their arm or the cane under their arm. They don't need it anymore. In fact, Cheryl, the very first patient you saw, the balance patient, she gave Yuri her cane. Said, I don't need this anymore. I'm cured. Technically, she's not cured. What we have figured out how to do is to retrain her brain to assume normal function. And with that, Gary Larson cartoon, even scientists need to have fun. Did I hear the ice cream truck? Oh, there's dessert on the table. So at that point, thank you for your attention. Thank you for your interest. And I will switch off here, and we are more than willing to take questions. Thank you. And now, yes, you can hear me. Okay, and your first question, sir. Actually, I'm going to ask you to repeat your comment and so that everybody in the audience can hear this. I'm a veteran as well as Yuri, so this is a personal issue for us. We have a certain passion.
Well, I was concerned about the military, especially because they're the larger group, but there's a secondary group of their volunteers. He mentioned one lady who had regressed, and I could see depression setting in for somebody who had experienced wonderful things and then regression. And I was also concerned about the length of time before they get this up and running and ready for the large numbers in the military. But my greatest concern is paying for it. I think for their volunteers, and especially for the military, it should be free, because we owe those young women who have been damaged in our service.
I wholly concur. One side note, we have had patients who we have invited to participate, and when we truth in research told them, you will, in all likelihood, get significantly better in this 5 or 10 day intervention. And then, because we don't have a device to give you, this was still a shoebox. This device right here is literally 2 weeks old. We've just developed this. In fact, I'm going back to the lab this afternoon to coat it in epoxy so to make it used for human subjects. We would tell them, you're going to get better, and then in all likelihood, without use of the device, you're going to get worse. You're going to go back to your old ways. We've had patients decline participation because they didn't want to feel better and then go back. Depression, and as you saw Cheryl dancing and with Paul and jumping rope, the euphoria is followed oftentimes by dysphoria. They got their life back, and then it was slowly wrenched from their fingers. So you're absolutely right. And the military personnel ought to get it for free.
Can I add, we have seen on public television veterans who get some care from the VA and from the medical. But once they're back home, whatever is available, they have to find on their own and pay on their own currently.
Yes, that's true. This device could be something they could use whenever they needed to for the rest of their lives. It would not be that expensive to stim.
Do you have any explanation for the wide variability in, you know, the patients that are treated with this? For example, I remember the chart on the MS patients.
Yes. Everybody comes in with a different set of symptoms and also degree of those symptoms. So that was a small cohort, 9 patients. If we were to do test this on 90 or 900, I suspect the variability would reduce over time. And our therapeutic intervention is still imperfect. Yuri, you want to speak to this?
Yes, it's very important because every patient is unique. If you probably notice, there are no similar patients, even with simple problem. When people coming with multiple sclerosis, 5 years, 17, 23 years after onset of the symptoms, they coming in a different condition. And one of the component, we can talk hours about this and why it's working and why it's, how to make it better, but for each patient, we're designing specific training protocol. So in the 10 years, we developed a set of rules that technology have to be adjusted to each patient. So because even with this, first of all, MS, if you know, it's multiple sclerosis, it's a very complex disease. There are 4 different type of disease, and in each type, you have 8 degrees of difficulties. Okay, so 0, the 1 is easy, and 9 people even cannot sit in a chair straight. So if you notice on the one of the picture when Mitch showed the dynamic gait index, everybody improved except one patient, and this one patient was in a chair. She was not capable of even sit straight. She dramatically improved during 2 weeks of training, but not for gait, but to keep the body straight. So that's why each symptom have to be evaluated specifically and scored, and it's different. The answer is simple, because all patients are different. That's why variability between them.
We can take 2 more questions.
Yes. Okay. No, I try to explain it very simple because I'm basically in the last 10 years I try to answer the same question every time. Well, I'm modifying my answer, but the question is very simple. So you deliver on the tip of the tongue few million electrical impulses, right? On the depth of 300 microns, electrical stimulation transferred to natural normal spikes. These spikes, million of them, coming to the brain, and then what? They spreading in the brain across connections, because major function of the brain is connections. That these million spikes have to do something, right? They're going from one point to another. They're not just stopping on the neurons, that they're transferring to neighbors, neighbors, and neighbors. We have preliminary data showing that in about 600 milliseconds, all brain is responded on a tongue stimulation. What it's mean? Now try to imagine that you're pumping the air in a flat tire. So now you're pumping spikes in the brain. And what's happening? Because in the last 30 years, people showing on the different models that if neural circuitry is exercising, it's become better. You know general principle of the brain, use it or lose it, right? If you look on the population of Alzheimer's disease or dementia, people who start to lose the memory, what's the major treatment for them? Entertainment. Okay, in all centers who are working with Alzheimer, major approach to keep the brain busy. But how you do it? You ask people watch the movie, they solve the Sudoku puzzles, crosswords, and so on. We are using another door, physically pumping in the brain millions and millions of impulses. And when this impulse is coming through the neural network, that improving quality of transduction, strengths a number of synaptical endings, and just improve the functional networks. If you have specific problem, like balance problem, you stimulate the brain and exercise a balance. And that's why circuitry that in the same time activated getting better. If you're working with Parkinson patient with hand tremor during stimulation, circuitry that's responsible for hands is getting better. If you're working people who have a memory problem and you do during stimulation memory exercise and different solving different problems, you improve the memory circuitry. So that's why our technology looks like not dramatically universal, but it can be applied in many different directions. And based on this principle, you can easily can see that we can help kids with learning disabilities, autistic kids where the brain is not developed. You can work with Alzheimer patients or memory loss patients, because when the brain start to degrade it naturally or age with a result of age-related disease, or you can work with traumatic injury and stroke. That's what you see here. So we showed you the examples how it's working. Did I answer your question? Good. Oh, yeah. Well, sure. Oh, yeah. Well, the question, what's people, blind people can get right now from this technology? That's not easy answer. Device is ready. And just a few hours ago, I got a phone call from Moscow. The few institutes in Moscow want to see this technology to test it on a subject. It's still experimental technology. You cannot buy it. It's not FDA approved, even for research purposes. It's pretty expensive, first of all. So it's about $15,000 system.
Have you had some success, though, in restoring vision?
Well, you have to understand, it's not restoring the vision. It's a replacement the vision. So we would show you another lecture for about an hour just to show what people are capable of. Believe me, we have a video. And if you go on our website, it's we can give you the cards later with our website. There is a reference on PBS movie specifically what people capable to do with this device after some training time. Some of them who is really enthusiastic, pretty often in about 5-6 days, even forgetting that they have a device. Because people who start to learn how to use a cane, in about months or two, not even realizing that they use a cane. They build the image immediately just touching an environment. They're not feeling what's happening in the hand. The same with our patients. No one, I tested maybe 11 or 12 blind subjects with this technology. Everybody start to tell you that I see, okay? For in their mind, even congenitally blind people use the word see, I'm seeing you, okay? I'm seeing the ball, I'm seeing the target. So they perceive it as a vision. And for them, yes, they're restoring ability to navigate in space, to navigate themselves in the kitchen, to use the cap on the table, open the door, walking, and that's what we last development that we did. The blind people, they coming in the room, looking on the trash can and throwing the ball in there. They're capable to do that. Is it a vision restoration? Definitely not. It's replacement. It's substitution. It's definitely give the freedom and ability people to navigate themselves in space. How far we can go with this technology, we even cannot predict. Because in our shelf, there is some project how to make the color vision, how to use a stereoscopic vision. So it's potentially possible, but it's need to be developed.
I'm being told we need to be respectful of the clock, and so we will all be here afterwards. Thank you again for your attendance, and thank you for inviting us to present to you today.
Thank you for joining us for this installment of the Bascom Hill Society Showcase Series podcast. For more information on this and other topics, please visit the University of Wisconsin Foundation homepage at www.uwfoundation.wisc.edu.